Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a video on the What Would You Say channel called Definitions Matter, Rights. Guessing from the first bit of the video that I've seen, I imagine this one is going to be them trying desperately to explain why it's okay for them to not want LGBTQ people to have equal rights. So let's see what word games we're in for.
You're in a conversation and someone starts talking about rights. Human rights, women's rights, gay rights, trans rights. Or maybe they refer to things like healthcare, income, or a job as rights. What would you say?
Well, most of that seems fine. I'm not sure I'd agree that a job is a right, but certainly the basic necessities of life should be rights. Even the infamous libertarian economist Milton Friedman agreed with a sort of universal basic income program structured as a negative income tax, which was meant to replace all of the myriad benefits that are available to impoverished people now. Essentially, it's like a progressive rather than a flat tax system, but instead of ending at 0% tax rate once your income hits a certain low threshold, it actually goes to a negative, meaning that if you earn under a certain amount of money per year, you pay negative tax. So you actually get money, and that bolsters your income to a point where you can still afford to live without having to worry about qualifying for all of the various benefits and programs. Canada actually implemented a pilot program that was structured this way in the 1970s. Unfortunately, the government changed after it had been running for a few years, but before the final report was issued, so the program was canceled. The data from the program was reviewed in 2011, and it was found that among the people who qualified for the program, there were only two groups who experienced a reduction in willingness to work: new mothers and teenage boys who decided to stay in school instead of work. There was also an 8.5% reduction in hospital visits in that town during the program, and there were fewer low birth weight babies. So, as it turns out, not living in poverty is actually better for your health than living in poverty. Who knew? Now, what is the optimal way to calculate how much someone gets and what the cutoff is, or whether there even is a cutoff? I don't know. I'm not an economist. What I do know is that in the vast majority of cases where any sort of no-strings-attached regular payment was made to people living in poverty, the results were overwhelmingly positive. Better scholastic performance for kids, better income for those receiving benefits, that is, income from work, not income from the benefit itself, an increase in the number of business startups, better health, more people training to get better jobs, and so on. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund has shown repeatedly that reducing taxes on the wealthy does not have quite the trickle-down effect that proponents of such policies claim, and the increased economic growth that does actually result from those types of tax cuts does not actually offset the loss of revenue that results from that cut. So, yeah, all this to say that I don't necessarily consider having a job to be a right, but I do consider not living in poverty to be a right. How we as a society should accomplish that can be debated, but saying, fuck the poor, they can pull themselves up by their bootstraps, is pretty definitively the worst way to do it, both from an emotional I want to help people standpoint, and from a more cold and calculating I don't want to dole out free money unless there's data to support that it will actually address the underlying causes of poverty standpoint.
Definitions matter. In conversations, we often find ourselves using the same vocabulary as others, but not the same dictionary.
Yeah, tell me about it. Just ask anyone who deals with creationists regularly about the definition of the word theory.
So, the next time someone uses the word rights about defining it, here are three things to remember. Number one, a right doesn't mean something I really want.
As a general rule, yeah, I can agree with that to a point, but I feel like this is one of those all X are Y, but not all Y are X scenarios. All rights are things that we really want, but not everything we really want is a right. Of course, wants are subjective, and rights are things that are general rules that are supposed to be equally applied to everyone, so this isn't going to be 100% true all of the time, but it's close enough for me.
Just because you want something, even very badly, doesn't mean it's a right. I may want my neighbor's car, but that doesn't give me the right to drive off with it.
Yeah, I know. Does anyone think that it does?
I may want society to pay me for never working again, but that doesn't give me the right I demanded.
And that is how benefits that are supposed to help people escape from poverty get demonized to a point where they become incredibly difficult to obtain, ostensibly to stop the supposedly lazy loafer from taking advantage of them. In order to qualify, you often have to wait until you're at the point of complete destitution. And usually people who wind up in complete destitution are unable to recover for the rest of their lives. If benefits were available before that moment, it could stop people from falling into the poverty cycle in the first place, which would actually end up saving the government money in the long term. But people are so scared of entitlements potentially being abused that the entitlements themselves become a hindrance to financial recovery, often even to the point of people using such benefits winding up paying a marginal tax rate that is significantly higher than the high income earners. The result there is that people on such benefits are actively discouraged from working. I actually remember being on unemployment myself during the slow season at a restaurant I used to work at. In Ontario, you're allowed to make a certain amount of money without any penalty, but after that point, every dollar you earn at your job is a dollar deducted from your unemployment check. So I would work the maximum number of shifts that I could before hitting that threshold, and then I would turn down any other shifts that were offered to me because why would I work for money that I was getting for free? If, however, the benefit were unconditional, just paid out regardless of hours worked and based on your annual income, then there's no incentive to turn down those extra shifts. Yeah, the following year my benefit might be smaller, but that's because I'm actually making more money. Again, I recognize that I have not laid out a completely nuanced and fully fleshed out solution to the problem. There would still need to be something like a stopgap benefit to tide you over in between losing a high-paying job that left you without the negative income tax payment and the next time your taxes are assessed. But my point is that the picture of social programs as society paying me to never work again is even less nuanced and fleshed out than my position, and the data supports mine.
This is especially true when what I want is impossible. If I said, I want to be a bird, I have the right to be a bird. That doesn't mean I can fly when I jump off a 10-story building. Reality doesn't change in order to conform to my made-up right.
Again, this is not something that anyone thinks. Though, at least with this one, I can see where you're headed. It's headed to transphobia. That's where it's headed.
In the same way, a man may really want to be a woman, but that doesn't give him the right or the ability.
Boom! Called it! The problem here is that reality supports the existence of trans people. A 2008 study points out that even then, the research indicated that both gender identity and sexual orientation develop in the uterus. The research has continued to support this conclusion as time has gone on, including identifying genes that could cause people to be trans, twin studies showing a significantly higher rate of identical twins both being trans than fraternal twins, and more. And as more research is done, it becomes more and more clear that the treatment with the best outcomes for trans people is gender-affirming care. And despite the fear-mongering that goes on in transphobic circles, this does not mean chopping the penises off of kids. It's mostly stuff like years of seeing a therapist, puberty blockers, hormone replacement therapy, and eventually, the possibility of surgery. Not all trans people get surgery, not all trans people even want surgery, but one thing is 100% clear. Surgery is not something that is entered into lightly. For kids, basically their only treatment options are puberty blockers that may or may not lead to hormone therapy, and talk therapy, with puberty blockers showing all indications at this time of being relatively safe and fully reversible. The main long-term side effect that seems to crop up with puberty blockers is low bone density, with research showing that this is likely due to a higher incidence rate of low bone density for trans individuals before they start puberty blockers, rather than it being an actual side effect of the drugs themselves. Worth going over here is that puberty blockers are not permanent. Usually, trans kids will take them for a few years while still attending therapy and socially transitioning. The puberty blockers are meant to give them more time to figure out whether or not they actually are trans before actual hormone treatments begin. The whole point of the puberty blockers is to delay puberty in order to take gender-affirming care slow and steady, making sure that gender dysphoria is actually what's going on, and that it's not just social pressure or some other underlying mental health problem. So keep that in mind next time you see someone engaging in the fear-mongering about performing surgeries on kids. Nobody is rushing kids into these sorts of procedures. The standard of care for trans kids is to do as little as possible for as long as possible in order to make sure that the kid actually is trans before we do something irreversible. But also, prevent them from going through a form of puberty that will cause their dysphoria to worsen, sometimes to the point of suicide, if they actually are trans. So yeah, anyway, to bring it back to the video, something is not just a right because you really want it to be, especially when that thing is something that conflicts with reality. So it is not your right to discriminate against trans people because that conflicts with the reality of their existence. I know you want to do that really, really badly, but as you so aptly pointed out yourself, wanting something really badly does not make it a right. Oh, and also, as long as we're talking about genital surgery on kids, how about circumcision? Do you oppose that if you're anti-trans? Because that is literally making a permanent change to a child's body that will impact how they experience sex for the rest of their lives, usually at a time when they are completely unable to consent or even understand what the heck is going on, because it's a fucking baby.
And it doesn't mean that he has the right to demand that others agree and act as if it's true.
And this is the Mott and Bailey fallacy on full display. If you're not familiar, a Mott and Bailey fallacy is based on a Mott and Bailey-style castle, where there's a relatively exposed section called the Bailey, and a more robust, easier-to-defend keep known as the Mott. If an enemy attacks, you can defend the Bailey for as long as possible, but once the Bailey is penetrated, your troops can retreat to the much more defensible Mott and potentially weather the whole attack. In argument form, it happens when two aspects of an argument are conflated as though they are inextricably linked, but one argument is significantly easier to defend than the other. In the case of transphobic arguments, one common Bailey is the whole kids are getting their penises chopped off thing, which is a completely indefensible position as it just does not happen. When this is pointed out, they retreat to the motto of, well, you can't coerce speech, so you can't make me respect someone's pronouns. Which is actually a true statement. You can't force someone to be respectful. But the thing is, this will just turn you into a douchebag. If someone tells you that they are a woman, it's not incumbent upon them to show you that they have a vagina and present their birth certificate showing that they were assigned female at birth. It's on you to treat them as though they are a woman. If you don't think that they are, then the safe road for you is to treat them as though they are anyway. There are plenty of cis women who don't present in a stereotypically feminine way. In fact, I'd wager that there are more cis women with less than stereotypical femininity in their presentation than there are trans women total. So if you accuse someone of being a man because you don't think they look feminine enough to be a woman, odds are, you're just being a dick to a cis woman rather than a trans woman. Either way, you're still a dick. But since the odds are that your dickish behavior is being aimed at a cis woman, you don't get to claim to be acting like a dick in the name of defending cis women against having to tolerate trans women. You're just a dick.
No one has the right to ignore reality, no matter how badly they want to.
And yet, here you are, making a video about how you don't think that trans people exist, even though reality disagrees with you.
Number two, rights come from God, not from the government.
I suppose that if a God existed, that might be a consideration, but since all indications point to him not existing, I'd say that it's impossible for rights to come from him.
The American Declaration of Independence says that all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights.
Yeah, sure, that was written in the Declaration of Independence, but the Declaration of Independence is not the document that the government uses to determine what the rights of its constituents are. That would be the Constitution, which does not credit God with human rights anywhere. And do I even need to mention at this point that the men who wrote that didn't seem to notice a discrepancy between saying all men have certain unalienable rights, while they actively refused to grant those very rights to the slaves that they owned?
According to Thomas Jefferson, these rights were not given by the government.
And yet, they didn't extend to all people until the government extended them to all people. Hell, as I'm sure we're going to get into in a moment, they still don't extend equally to all people. If God is so concerned with protecting our rights, then why is the government even necessary for that purpose? Couldn't God himself protect our rights? And really, wouldn't he be way better at it than the government?
In fact, these rights precede the government. It is the government's responsibility to secure them.
Why, though? Why is it the government's responsibility to secure something that's supposed to be secured by God? Is God so weak that he can't do it himself and he needs these human agencies to actually do the work on his behalf?
While this kind of language comes from thinkers like John Locke, the concept itself is much older. In fact, it's rooted ultimately in the Ten Commandments.
So, you're saying that human rights are rooted in the Ten Commandments, a set of rules that includes the explicit condoning of the practice of slavery? The fourth includes a line where you have to give your slaves the Sabbath day off, and the tenth is that you're not allowed to want your neighbor's slaves. Neither says that it's wrong to own slaves. You just need to give them one day off a week, and you're not allowed to get jealous that your neighbor can afford more slaves than you. That seems like a pretty shitty document from which to derive human rights. Also, I didn't mention this in last week's video because it was already the longest video in that series, and it was also the one that I opened with, "This might be a short video," to boot. But the Ten Commandments that we're all familiar with from Exodus 20 are not, in fact, the Ten Commandments that the Bible refers to as the Ten Commandments. Just ignore the headings when you read it. They weren't there in the original text. They were added by translators. Nowhere in Exodus 20 does it say that these are the Ten Commandments. However, if you go to Exodus 34, there's another set of rules which are explicitly referred to by the text as the Ten Commandments. But those aren't the ones that people argue are the basis of our moral laws, or should be displayed prominently in courthouses and classrooms, even though they are the final copy of the Ten Commandments that ended up being put in the Ark of the Covenant, according to the story. And that's likely because, while the Exodus 20 commandments have a couple of decent rules in them, the Exodus 34 ones do not. The Exodus 34 commandments forbids miscegenation, lists a bunch of feasts that you're supposed to keep, tells you not to boil a kid in its mother's milk, and even very heavily implies that you're supposed to give your firstborn children to God as a human sacrifice. There's also 13 commandments by my count on the list of 10 commandments, but I'm sure that's just down to it being unclear exactly where you're supposed to break them up into separate commandments, rather than the author of Exodus just not even knowing how to count to 10. You'd think that the inspired word of God would be a bit more clear than that, but I guess not. Really, my question here is, why do Christians default to the rough draft of the Ten Commandments from Exodus 20 when the Bible clearly states that Exodus 34 is the final copy? I actually already know the answer. It's because the Exodus 20 commandments are easier to show in a favorable light, though they're still pretty rough.
"You shall not murder" is another way of expressing the right to life. "You shall not steal" is another way of expressing the right to property.
And that's it. He gives us two of the Ten Commandments as examples to show that the Ten Commandments are the basis for our rights. Never mind that the first and fourth commandment of the Exodus 20 version violate the rights to religious freedom, the second and third commandments violate the right of free expression, and the tenth commandment completely undercuts our current economic system. So 40% of the Ten Commandments would be explicit human rights violations if they were actually enacted as law, and then the last commandment would cause significant economic upheaval, to say the least. And then there's the seventh commandment, the one against adultery. That one, while I agree it is a good rule, should not be a law. Come to think of it, that might violate the freedom of association? That one's a bit iffy, so at best, 40% of the Ten Commandments are rights violations, and at worst, fully half of them are. Now, sure, these guys could be consistent if they were of the opinion that the rights that would be violated if the Ten Commandments became law were some of those rights that they're trying to dismiss as not being real rights or whatever, but unfortunately for them, there's another video on their channel where they explicitly state that freedom of religion is a God-given right, not a government-granted right.
"Religious freedom is not a right created by the government. It is what many philosophers have called a natural right, a God-given right that belongs to everyone, regardless of what the government says."
So, yeah, I'm not exactly sure how they would square freedom of religion being a God-given right with the fact that the Ten Commandments would violate freedom of religion if they were to be made laws.
"Throughout history, Christian thinkers have insisted that good laws secure our rights because they agree with God's highest moral law. When a human law contradicts that moral law, it's no law at all."
So the First Amendment is no law at all? That's a weird position for you to hold.
"In the 20th century, this was the basis of the Civil Rights Movement, in which Martin Luther King Jr. declared that segregation laws violated the God-given rights of African Americans, and therefore were no laws at all."
Interestingly, if you put quotation marks around that statement when you Google it, even though they have it presented as a direct quote, you get a grand total of four results, three of which are from whatwouldyousay.org, the fourth is from hillfaith.org on their page where they link to this video. Now, he did say something along those lines, but let's hear his actual words, shall we? It's going to be a bit of a lengthy quote to make sure you get full context, but I think it's worth it. It's from his letter from a Birmingham jail. "You express a great deal of anxiety over our willingness to break laws. This is certainly a legitimate concern. Since we so diligently urge people to obey the Supreme Court's decision of 1954 outlawing segregation in the public schools, at first glance, it may seem rather paradoxical for us to consciously break laws. One may well ask, how can you advocate for breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer lies in the fact that there are two types of laws, just and unjust. I would be the first to advocate obeying just laws. One has not only a legal, but a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. I would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is no law at all. Now, what is the difference between the two? How does one determine whether a law is just or unjust? A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. To put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal law and natural law. Any law that uplifts human personality is just. Any law that degrades human personality is unjust. All segregation statutes are unjust because segregation distorts the soul and damages the personality. It gives the segregator a false sense of superiority and the segregated a false sense of inferiority. I'd highly recommend that you actually check out the whole letter and read the whole thing from start to finish. Although that might be illegal in Florida now because that might be considered critical race theory, but I've got a few things that are notable here. First, his appeal to God is rather predictable given that he was a reverend. Second, even though he was a reverend who believed fervently in the Christian God, he still went out of his way to say that a just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. That's or, not and. He's leaving the door open for secular morality. And he was always very intentional with his words. This was not a whoopsie-doodle, I meant only God's law gives us rights. He meant to word it that way. And he goes on to define an unjust law as a law that degrades human personality. I'd say that having cops who are cis men entering women's washrooms to kick out a cis woman because someone reported her for being trans is pretty dehumanizing.
And I'm in the back. I'm a fucking female.
This is a girl.
Do I have to tell you again?
You have ID?
No, I do not.
Get out.
Then out.
You've got no ID. Get out.
This is so sad.
Out.
Oh, and she's a girl and you're yelling in her face.
You
That's
see
crazy.
This, right?
Don't worry. I got you.
Being asked for identification in order to use the toilet because you don't present as feminine enough to satisfy someone's arbitrary standard of how feminine you have to be to count as a woman in their opinion is something that degrades human personality for all women, trans and cis. So having degrading laws that require people to carry ID on them in order to confirm that they are using the correct bathroom is unjust. And according to the larger context of that sentiment expressed by Reverend Dr. King, we then have a moral responsibility to disobey those laws. Though in this case, a bit of prudence is warranted. If you live somewhere like Florida where it's illegal to use a bathroom that doesn't match your sex assigned at birth, I am not recommending that cis men use the women's room or vice versa. And realistically, a trans person should only disobey that law if it is actually safe for them to do so.
Number three, there is no right to take away someone else's rights.
With various exceptions, of course, but we'll get to that, I'm sure.
True rights don't conflict. This is vital to understand. For example, when someone talks about women's rights, they may mean things like women being able to vote or drive. Or they may be using women's rights as code for abortion.
Yeah, see, that one is called bodily autonomy. People have a right to their own body, which includes the right to not have other people use it for themselves. So even if you consider a fetus to be worthy of personhood right from the moment of fertilization, when it doesn't even have a brain, much less a consciousness, then that person does not automatically have the right to use another person's body to stay alive. Of course, that's not all there is to it, and there are a plethora of reasons why it would be completely ridiculous to grant personhood to a fetus at any stage of development, but even if I grant your side of the argument, abortion is still encapsulated in the right to bodily autonomy. But also, I'm not granting your side of the argument. When you consider a fetus to be a person, you wind up with instances like the Missouri Department of Transportation claiming that a fetus of one of their pregnant employees was also an employee, because if it's a person, then they're on the hook for wrongful death. But if it was also employed by them, then they're off the hook, because apparently employers are shielded from wrongful death lawsuits if an employee dies on the job, which seems hella fucked up even without them claiming to have employed a 6-month-old fetus. I hope the person suing them demands back pay. If they were employing a fetus without paying it, that's not only a violation of child labor laws, that's also a violation of minimum wage laws. And remember about a year ago when that pregnant woman in Texas got a ticket for driving alone in the carpool lane and fought the ticket based on the fact that she was pregnant, and after the overturning of Roe v. Wade, her fetus legally counts as a person, so she wasn't driving alone? Yeah, She won that one. You can drive in the HOV lane alone and pregnant in states that consider fetuses to be people now. The precedent has been set. And what about pregnant prisoners? The fetus didn't get due process. That imprisonment violates their rights. What about pregnant cancer patients who need chemotherapy? Chemotherapy could potentially harm the fetus. Do we force the patient to delay chemotherapy until after they give birth, potentially resulting in their cancer progressing to untreatable stages? Well, remember when you said that true rights don't conflict? Well, if a fetus has a right to life, but its continued existence endangers the life of the person carrying it, that creates a conflict. So I guess the right to life isn't a true right if rights don't conflict.
But notice that voting and driving don't take away anyone else's rights.
Don't they, though? If you vote for a politician who runs on a platform of taking away people's rights, then yeah, you voting might not directly be the action that takes away other people's rights, but it did lead to it. So yes, voting can take away other people's rights. As to driving, plenty of people die in accidents every year, so clearly the right to drive does, at least sometimes, conflict with the right to life. And as I have already pointed out, providing a fetus with the right to life will interfere with the rights of the person carrying it, including their right to life.
Killing an unborn child does.
Only if you grant personhood to the fetus, which comes with a whole host of other problems that it would be best to avoid.
In the same way, gay rights are sometimes code for forcing Christian bakers to celebrate homosexuality.
I know that the Masterpiece Cake Shop thing went the wrong way for you to be able to make that argument, but the thing is, if you open a public-facing business, you should not be allowed to discriminate when it comes to offering your service, especially not against immutable characteristics like race and sexual orientation. Now, sure, if a particular customer is being problematic, you can refuse to serve that customer, but imagine if a black couple walked into a bakery and asked for a cake for their wedding, and the baker replied with, "We don't bake cakes for black people's weddings." That's the kind of discrimination that Martin Luther King was fighting against. I'm sure there were racist bakers who, after the Civil Rights Act was passed, felt like they were being forced to celebrate people that they saw as inferior. Would you prefer that they be allowed to engage in such discrimination? Because that's exactly what you are saying about gay people here. If you're a Christian baker who is opposed to gay marriage, just don't bake wedding cakes. At all. Then you never have to worry about it.
Or for forcing Catholic adoption agencies to place children with same-sex couples.
The fact that you'd rather leave kids in foster care and orphanages than see them adopted into loving homes where the parents are both the same sex is kind of gross, to be honest. Especially given that a recent meta-analysis of 34 studies looking at outcomes in children of LGBTQ parents and comparing their outcomes to children of heterosexual cis parents found that the children of LGBTQ parents did just as favorably in most outcomes as the children of heterosexual cis parents. And in the areas where it wasn't approximately equal, like psychological adjustment, the children of LGBTQ parents did better than the children of heterosexual cis parents. The only area of concern was social stigma. The results of these studies might not be generally applicable, because the studies were mostly carried out in countries with wide social acceptance of the LGBTQ community. In other words, assholes like you making videos demonizing LGBTQ people for wanting equal rights are the only thing that is likely to do any sort of harm to children of LGBTQ parents. And while it pretty much goes without saying, similar research into kids raised in foster care and orphanages consistently finds worse outcomes than those raised in stable households. So to advocate for leaving kids in institutional care rather than allow them to be taken into a stable household purely out of bigotry against LGBTQ people just seems petty and cruel.
Trans rights are often code for forcing women to give up their right to privacy in a locker room.
Oh, you're worried about women having the right to privacy? So then you're against the bathroom bills that have resulted in numerous women, both trans and cis, being accosted and harassed because someone didn't think they looked feminine enough? Do women not have the right to privacy if their hair is too short, or their voice is too deep, or their muscles are too prominent? Hell, take a look at this guy. This is Sean Stinson, a trans man. As of July 1st this year, if he goes to Florida, he will legally be required to use the women's bathroom and change rooms. What is he supposed to do there? Honestly, though, that's a bit of an extreme example. There are trans people who don't easily pass as their gender identity, and really they are the ones that the bill is aimed at. There are exceptions in the bill for intersex people, parents helping small children, someone assisting an elderly person, or someone assisting a disabled person. And as illegal as it may be for Sean to use the men's room, realistically, he's not going to get challenged. The target is trans women who don't pass, And they don't care that a bunch of cis women will face discrimination and humiliation as collateral damage, because the reality is, there are cis people who do not pass as their gender identity. Men who look feminine but identify as men and were assigned male at birth. And there are women who look masculine, they identify as women, and they were assigned female at birth. Those people will all now have to worry about someone calling the police on them for having to use the washroom, with them potentially having to provide paperwork to prove that they were assigned that sex at birth. Intersex people could also be required to provide proof that their doctor diagnosed them as intersex. And all of this hubbub is ostensibly to protect women, to keep them safe in their private spaces. Except the thing is, in all of North America, there has been a grand total of one case where a man dressed as a woman in order to get into a women's space and assault them. That was in Toronto, and it happened before Ontario enacted protections that would allow trans women into such spaces. In other words, even if he was trans, which he wasn't, but even if he was, it was illegal for him to dress up as a woman to enter a women's space, even if he hadn't assaulted anyone. Yet, he still did it. So this doesn't exactly help the case that making it illegal for trans people to use the bathroom that matches their gender identity will make things safer for women. Quite the contrary, as already discussed, it is accomplishing the exact opposite of that, resulting in cis male police officers being called in to force cis women out of the women's bathroom for not being able to present the proper identification. Now, at this point in the video, I'd like to take a moment to make a statement to the people who, when I make a video like this, tell me to stay in my lane and only cover religion. First, congratulations on actually making it this far into the video. I'm sure there are going to be a bunch of comments of that nature made by people who only watched the first bit, so thanks for actually watching this far before commenting. Second, my default response when Christians make comments asking me why I spend so much time talking about something I don't believe in, or accuse me of really believing in God because if I didn't, I wouldn't dwell on Christianity so much, or other comments of that nature, is to point out that beliefs inform actions, and actions impact society. The current crusade against trans rights is mostly being spearheaded by Christian organizations, lobby groups, and politicians, and they explicitly appeal to their religion as the reason why they're on this crusade. Yes, I'm getting political in this one, but that's not because I'm shifting my focus to politics, it's because Christianity has invaded politics and is having a real political impact. Christianity and American politics are so intertwined at this point that it's impossible to address one without venturing into the other. So, sorry, not sorry.
Almost every time new rights are invented, someone else's God-given rights are trampled.
Except the God-given rights that are being represented on screen here are the Catholic orphanage's right to keep children in an environment where they have objectively worse outcomes, women's rights to have private spaces where they don't have to worry about being accused of not being feminine enough lest police be involved, and a baker's right to run their business in a discriminatory way. If those are the rights that come from God, then God sucks at doling out rights.
It's very popular to talk about rights today. It's a term that enters nearly every political debate, often used by someone claiming a right to something that they really want.
Like how you really want the right to discriminate based on bigotry. Nobody is saying that you don't have the right to be a bigot, you're still allowed to believe bigoted things, but you shouldn't have the right to run a public-facing business based on your bigotry. Also, there are frequently social consequences for bigotry, and these consequences are often mistaken for being a violation of the person's rights. Like when people get banned from Twitter for hate speech. It's a violation of my freedom of speech! No, it's not. You don't have the right to use Twitter. Twitter is just a product. It's a business. You agree to the terms of service when you sign up, and if you violate them, you get kicked off. That's just how it works. That's not a violation of your rights. You still have a right to say and believe the things that got you kicked off of Twitter, but being on Twitter is not a right. You don't have a right to a platform. Take me, for instance. I have a platform here on YouTube. I do not invite white supremacists onto my platform to share their viewpoint, and if I find out that someone who has been on my platform holds views or behaves in ways that I don't like, I do not have to have them back on. It's not a freedom of speech issue, it's my platform. I get to choose what goes on it, and that's my freedom of speech. There are people with whom I have shared this platform who will never be invited back. I am not denying them their freedom of speech, I am exercising mine. You have the freedom to express your ideas. You do not have the freedom to force someone else to provide you with a stage from which to do it.
In reality, the only real definition for rights goes back centuries, is rooted in human dignity, and grounded in the unchanging law of God.
The unchanging law of God endorses slavery and genocide and has been used throughout history to justify the removal of human dignity from huge groups of people. From people who have other religions, to people who have a different version of the same religion, to people of color, to LGBTQ people, to children, and more. The unchanging law of God is many things, but rooted in human dignity is not one of those things.
This means that anyone who makes up or demands new rights is just wrong.
So, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who you quoted as an authority in defining a right, was wrong because he wanted to make up new rights that would treat people of color as equal to white people? That is a weird position to take in this year of our Lord 2023, but okay, I guess. Seems like the official position of the What Would You Say channel is that they want to go back to segregation at least, and possibly even slavery. Or that would be their position if they were actually being consistent here, but they're not. They just want to be bigots against LGBTQ people and don't know how to effectively separate that bigotry from being essentially the same kind of bigotry as racism. How about we just give everyone equal rights? Why is that so hard? Whatever rights straight white cis people have, LGBTQ people and people of color get as well. Want to get married? Sure, anyone can marry anyone they like. That's their right. Want to have a kid? Sure, that's your right. Want to take a shit without being harassed and asked for papers? Sure, that's your right. Why do you have a problem with that? How does treating everyone equally hurt anyone? Rights are not a pie with a limited number of slices that when you expand rights to include minority groups, suddenly the majority has fewer rights. I didn't lose the right to get married when gay marriage became legal in Canada. In fact, I actually got married on the exact day that gay marriage became legal in Ontario, and I didn't even realize it for more than a decade. If allowing gay marriage somehow lessened straight marriage, you'd think that I would have noticed earlier that my rights had been curtailed. But they weren't, so I didn't. The rest of their video is just a summary, so that's where I'll leave it for today. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Stephen Widger, who says, "Fun fact about the philosophical teachings of hedonism, the greatest form of pleasure one can feel is to bring joy to others. Everyone seems to forget that part." Indeed, I neglected to mention that in the video where I brought it up, but that is a significant aspect of pleasure. So yeah, hedonism all the way, man. Thanks for watching. I'll be back next Friday with more, but if you need to get your rhino fix in before then, I livestream with Cirrus every Wednesday at 8:30 Eastern on my other channel, The Watering Hole. Thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon and sponsorships manager, and special thanks as always to my patrons, who are the religion that interferes with the politics of my channel. If you'd like to make it impossible to honestly address one without also covering the other, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my PO Box address is in the description. See you next time!